I think every team realistically would be speaking about it. I've always said that unless I felt drunk with an All-Ireland, I wouldn't play because the sacrifices are just too high.
OTB AM, live weekday mornings from 7:30 on the OTB Sports app.
Every year, one thing is always predictable. Postage costs go up. Stamps.com gives you crazy discounts of up to 89% off USPS and UPS services, so your business will barely notice the change. Stamps.com has been indispensable for over 1 million businesses just like yours. It's like your own personal post office. No lines, no traffic, no waiting. Sign up with promo code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com code PROGRAM.
Now, I'm delighted to say Ray Goggins is with us in studio. His new book is out. It's called Ranger 22, Lessons from the Front. Ray, everyone's going to know you from the telly now.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, so are you getting recognised walking down the street?
A little bit more than maybe previously, yeah. But look, that's grand. People are very good about it, you know. There's no one trying to kill me yet.
So what are the former sports people like? How good have they been?
Yeah, they're very good. They're really committed to the whole experience. That was probably, to be honest, one of our concerns. We weren't sure, you know, how they would rate. Would their mindset be good for it? No, but we had no worries. They were brilliant. They really got stuck in.
And is the aim to try and break them, essentially?
No, it's people think it's break. You're not trying to break. You're testing. Like, to be honest, for us in the real world, in actual special forces, when you're testing these guys, the more guys you get over the line, the better. That means you can train more, you'll have more people in your teams. So despite what it looks like, we set the conditions for people to succeed. It's up to them then to meet the line. We can't drop the line down to them. So you want them to win, but you can't help them to win, if you know what I mean. So
yeah, I've definitely spoken to people before who've come through the Ranger training, and I was very surprised at how few managed to make it through. That the whole way along, you're trying to weed out people who won't make it. You didn't make it through the first time.
No, I didn't, because I wasn't mentally prepared, which is the biggest lesson I learned. I hadn't committed to what I was doing. I had doubts. I was worrying about stuff. I didn't need to worry about all those things. But
so this is 1992?
92, yeah.
What age were you at that stage?
Oh, I was 21, yeah. So I was, yeah, but look, I hadn't prepared correctly. I hadn't trained properly up for it. I just went kind of at the last minute kind of a thing.
For what now? For just explain to
Oh, sure, yeah. So I was in the regular army at the time in the infantry. And at the time, the rangering would set out what they call the road show. They'd send lads around to all the barracks with all the fancy gear and the beards and all the stories and all, looking like rock stars. So it's like the Pied Piper, and all the little mice would run after him back up to the car and get killed. So I thought, it, yeah, look, I was really fit, but look, fitness is a very small percentage of it. It's all mindset. So I hadn't prepared, I hadn't trained, and I went on selection. And 2 weeks in, I wasn't coping at all, so I quit over a period of time. So learned a massive lesson out of that.
What did they put you through?
So it was all very intense. The physicality, obviously, look, it's like what you see in the show, only at a higher level, because what the show doesn't bring across is, like, you know, in the military, it's probably another 25-30% of intensity on top of what you see on the show, because you're looking for someone at the end of the day. We're dealing in the application of lethal violence, so that there's a lot. That's the end goal. It's not about being able to run up mountains. It's being able to get over that mountain and carry out a job on the other side of that mountain. So that's kind of what we're looking at. So it's much more intense.
And how many people do actually make it through?
It's roughly, like, no matter how many start, it's roughly 10% is the pass rate. Like that course you mentioned there in 2002, there was like 120 guys passed, and like a handful got in. Like, I think it was less than 10 finished it out in the end.
Okay, you make it in, sorry, so your first one is 92, is it?
92 is the first one, yeah.
Yeah, and then 99 you make it through.
99 I make it, yeah. Otherwise there'd be no book. If I didn't make it, it would have been a more boring book. But yeah, so I got in. I went back to my military career in the army. And look, the army's pretty intense too. Went overseas, you know, did some courses, got promoted, got some experience in service.
Always with the intention, having failed in 92,
yeah.
Was that something that you then decided, I'm going to get this at some point?
Yeah, it was always there. It was always something I felt, you know, obviously I hadn't given myself a full shot at it, and it was always in the back of my head, and I always felt like, you know, it's the one that got away. So it was in the back of my head for most of that time frame. And then it got closer and closer to the four until the last 18 months of it, a year, I just trained specifically for selection only, and that was it.
All right, and how do you do that when you're actually in the army? Or did you come out?
Well, on my own time.
Right,
so
okay.
Obviously I had to fulfill all my military duties,
okay,
overseas and all that stuff, but in my own time, on weekends, after hours, like, don't forget, in the army, you're training anyway physically. So I would up the intensity as I could.
So apart from the physical side, what's the psychological difference between you at 21, 22 and 27, 28, 29, whenever you make it?
The big one is belief in myself, my equipment. So I set the tone. That was one of the reasons why I failed. Like physically in the first one, I'd have been able for it. I just started worrying about stuff and I didn't believe in myself as a leader and what I was capable of doing. So I worked on that by getting experience and getting small positions in the military where I could take command of small groups overseas, like in Lebanon and places like that. So I built my confidence in myself and what I could do. So I had a very specific goal for the last year. So I trained my body and I trained my mind. You train your mind by confidence in yourself, your equipment, what you're doing and your knowledge. So if you can work on all those things, that'll bring your mind ready for you. So I started up in the ante then to put myself in awkward positions, you know, put myself under pressure, using adversity as much as I could, getting other people to design surprise training events for me that, like, I'm not prepared for. I just turn up and I have to do something, you know, like friends of mine who are in the military as well. So.
Okay. It always strikes me that confidence comes from having put the work in to know that I'm going to be able to give of my best in this, whatever the situation, the scenario is. And that's the thing that transfers over to sport, and it's kind of the thing that transfers from sport to everywhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a cardinal event. Like they used to say in the military, that victory loves preparation. So if you don't prepare, you prepare to fail. Yeah, like preparation is the key. If you have time to do it, you have to give it.
How does your life change when you make it through, when you're one of the 10% who makes it through?
It changes in a lot of ways. First of all is your training. Then once you're in the initial phase of it, it's called selection. It's like a 4 week of what you see on the TV at that intensity, but like worse, because you're carrying heavier weights and so on and so forth. So that's the initial phase. In the old way they did it, it's slightly different now. And then for the next 6-7 months after that, you're being trained up. So how it works so well, and why the team bonds so well, is it works off almost a vulnerability. So you're broken down to a place where each guy in your group has seen guys at their worst. They've seen guys when they're completely, like what we call, on your chin strap, like you're completely burnt out. And that's the time then when the group carries that individual. So that kind of bond is created. You mentioned earlier about breaking people down. That's what it is. You're creating that bond of people. You're not intentionally trying to break people down, but that bond then transfers into their training, and that transfers into operations and missions when you're working with guys and you have to put your life in a guy's hands. Like you've done everything with him, and like you've absolute trust, and that comes back to the belief as well.
How quickly did you get into the field operationally as a ranger after you?
Pretty quickly, really. Within months, I was in jungles in East Timor as part of a 6-man team carrying out operations against counterinsurgency elements, like, you know, basically attacking villages, killing people, burning crops, that kind of stuff. So our job is to stop them doing that, protect those people. So within months, I was in that team.
Because I'm not sure everybody understands that we have soldiers who are going out and doing
that.
We do. That.
Like, even at the moment, I know the Kabul rescue was grabbing a lot of highlights last week or the week before with the lads from the RW going and doing that. But you have to remember, so we have guys on the ground as well. In Mali, for example, like there's Army Rangering personnel on the ground in Mali conducting operations against insurgency and, you know, in that desert location. Like,
when you say conducting operations, what does that mean? Because, like, again, that's the terminology, but like in practical terms, what are they actually doing?
Yeah, you've a couple of different things that we'd break it down to. There's three main kind of ways your job would break down. So the first of all is what's called surveillance and reconnaissance. So you'll be gathering information. Then you have what are called direct action missions, which means hands-on, actually physically going in, either taking someone, taking someone out. Kinetic operations, which involves gunfire, I guess is the word people don't understand. And then the last one then is it's called FID. It's like a support of foreign governments, you know, so like training operations, training up their soldiers. They're the three main tasks, special forces will. So everything falls under that category.
Okay.
Really.
Ray, can I just ask you, like, from reading excerpts of the book, like you spoke about your dad and the impact maybe he had, and I guess there's probably like almost like a code of silence and an omerta around previous generations of military people, and certainly it's kind of like an Irish male thing that we don't talk and open up about our feelings as well. But like, what sort of things did you learn from your dad? Was becoming a ranger maybe something you wanted to do, having you seen your dad in the military, and I know he was in the Congo as well?
Yeah, I suppose the lesson I picked up from my father, who had served in the infantry all his life, and he had retired from the military by the time I came along. I was 2 when he retired, so I don't remember him physically being in the military. But what I do remember of him growing up is he was always calm. He was always, anything was never a problem for him. He always dealt with it very well, and he was always in good humour. Like, I can't remember him raising my voice. I'm sure he did raise his voice, but if he did, I don't remember. So that's what I took out of it really from him.
Like you mentioned the time in Afghanistan as well. I think it was 2.5 years that you spent in Afghanistan, and it really interesting to see. I think speak before about how being Irish over there can be a bit of a help. I think the way you put it was that Irish forces don't have this, you know, colonial hangover. Like what advantages did being Irish have for you over there?
Yeah, I think as Irish people, we have a natural affinity with like everybody, really. Like we've no expectations of people. We don't expect them to bow to us. So I found with the Afghan guys I worked with straight away, like, you know, I'd learned a language, for example. I was interested in, you know, their backgrounds, the culture of the country, so on and so forth. So I'd take steps to learn that thing. Like, whereas some of my colleagues who were great guys, now don't get me wrong, Americans, French guys, Germans, like they come from bigger cultures where they bring their culture with them. They don't leave it behind. So that's what they do in their countries. Whereas Irish lads, probably not so much, you know.
And like those trips to East Timor and the likes of Kosovo as well, the importance of family comes up and it crops up in the book as well. Like coming home to your, at the time, two young kids, like it strikes me that must be tough. You know, it sounds strange, but I guess even coming home and assimilating back into your own family, be something that's tough.
Absolutely, yeah. I'll be honest with you, like, you know, it's easier on the kind of operational side, like the mindset you take up, because I had done it so many times, no matter what the country was. You have a certain mindset and kind of stance going forward. But when you come home, then you have to, you know, go back to being that family guy or whoever you are. And sometimes I was as nervous, my wife's going to kill me here now, on the flight back to Dublin than I would be in the flight into Kabul, for example, because, you know, like, are the kids going to be okay? Is everyone going to be all right with me? Because my kids were small at the time, don't forget. And there's an adjustment period. So I'm only coming home for 4 weeks. You don't want to come home for 4 weeks, like, upset everybody, then go back for another few months, you know what I mean? So there's a bit of kind of management of it. But look, it was always great, obviously. But you just have those thoughts as well. So it's as hard, or if not harder, for the families than it is for the guy on the ground.
You speak in the book about how you needed to get a routine when you came home that involved good eating, getting out of bed, doing exercise, not drinking every day. Like, yeah. You know, you go on tour and maybe you don't process everything while it's there.
Yeah.
So you put it in a box, you come home. At some point the box kind of jimmies itself open.
Yeah, it does. And I what you're alluding to there is I had a particularly intense period of a couple of months where, yeah, I was dealing with whatever happened. You just deal with it and move on. But I had come home then and I just found that I was, you know, I just wasn't focused. I wasn't in a good place emotionally because I hadn't dealt with whatever was going on correctly. So that was a wake-up call for me. I was usually very good at doing that. But I had just neglected to do my usual procedures. So for a week or two, I was just a gobshite, like hanging around the house and not doing anything, I guess. But I kind of copped on a little bit. And for me, purpose is very important no matter what you're doing. Like if every day is a Saturday and you can sit in your arse, like it's hard to motivate yourself. You need to give yourself goals even when you're in your downtime.
Yeah.
You know, that you can keep yourself focused. And like for me, the connection is like for my kind of mental strength and emotional ability is very much linked with my physical. So I work all three together. So there's three things I do now every day that I feed, and it's going to sound very zen, but you got to feed your body, feed your mind, and feed your soul every day, however you do that. So your body obviously is fitness, looking after yourself. Your mind is by learning new things and experiences, and your soul is by doing whatever it is that makes you happy, that you really get joy out of, and whatever that is for you. Like,
that's kind of the point of the book, right?
Yeah, that's kind of where I came from. And like, even though it is a military book about a soldier, it's not all about a soldier's life. Like the lessons I learned in a lot of those situations from other people, better people than me, like all kinds of people.
A new year is full of surprises, but one thing is always predictable. Postage costs go up. Stamps.com gives you crazy discounts of up to 89% off USPS and UPS services. So when postage goes up, your business will barely notice the change. Stamps.com is like your own personal post office, wherever you are. You can even take care of orders on the go with the mobile app. No lines, no traffic, no waiting. Schedule package pickups, automatically find the cheapest and fastest shipping options, and seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. There's even a supply store where you can stock up on mailing supplies, labels, even printers. Stamps.com has been indispensable for over 1 million businesses just like yours. All you need is a computer or phone and printer. Take a chunk out of your mailing and shipping costs this year with Stamps.com. Sign up with promo code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com code program.
Not just army guys. We're like maybe how to approach things in your life and, you know, maybe just make things a bit better on yourself by being, you know, like the likes of some of the things I mentioned that people mightn't get. You know, they might think because it's an all an army book, it's all bullets and bombs. There's a lot more about like kindness, empathy, like, you know, humility with people, like, are the key values that I hold.
Not always associated with the military.
No, and like, to be honest, not, and it's like everything else. Look, you could get 100 guys from the ARW would write that book and it would be 100 different books because everyone brings their own. Yeah, the training's the same, your abilities are the same, but how you view life is completely different. It's all very individual, of course. So
the that bit there where you said you deal with it and move on, are you trained for that? Is there like a proper
course? There's several processes. Like we back in the old days, it was almost by osmosis, all these kind of psychologically proven things now and that people are doing. We were doing like 25, 30 years ago in a different way, like the likes of, you know, cognitive visualization, which is a huge part of mindfulness now. We were doing that like for operations. So, you know, you think and walk through what you're going to do exactly down to very small movements beforehand. So which gives you that mental strength.
But I guess I'm talking about that post-event. So
okay, sure, yeah. So
you're involved in a firefight, you see some stuff that you're never going to forget. You deal with that and move on, is how you phrased it, right?
Yeah, you do. But look, I probably glossed over that because to be respect to the military are very, very specific about how to deal with this. So they have their own kind of counsellors and they have their own kind of what are called the PSS, the Personal Support Service.
In every single movie, every single piece of pop culture that's ever been written by anybody involved in it, there's an intense mistrust of the psychologist who is assigned to the people. Is that real?
Again,
it's very macho.
No, it is, and you're right. Look, to be honest, look, in special ops, of course, there's a lot of alpha male stuff, and there's a lot of chest beating. That's part of it too. Like, you know, that adrenaline and that kind of that factor, it gets you through certain things, but it's not the end all. The psychology side of it, like, what the army were very smart. They used to have in the earlier days, they had like psychologists that would come in, and they were specific psychologists, and as you said, guys wouldn't relate to them. They feel like they're being undermined. But what the army did, they trained up actual serving soldiers to do this. So guys who already had a military career, they know what to look for, and they're personable then. They know how the guy thinks, not someone who learned it from a book or, you know, did it in college or whatever. So, and I think that connection is much better for guys. It's more trusting then. You talk more to guys if you have issues. But to be fair with the military, the Irish Army in particular, they're very good at dealing with that and helping people.
Okay. Shane, you had a couple more?
Yeah, just like what really struck me there from what you're saying, Ray, is that like, and what struck me from the book as well is that you kind of humanize it a bit. It's you know, I've read books about, you know, different guys in the States and SEAL Team 6 and, you know, Chris Kyle, the American sniper, and all these stories. And in the books, they kind of almost come across robotic, above human almost, that they're just these kind of guys who see terrible things, experience things, and just forget about it. But you kind of, I think one of the things you mentioned as well is that humor is such an important aspect of being in the military, that you need to be human. You need to feel and experience all those emotions.
Yeah, it's important to keep that in check because, look, like I get what you're saying about the, and that'd be my experience about those books as well. It's always about the kinetic side of it or the fighting. And they never talk about like the crack, because even when I think back to my career, like my mind doesn't necessarily go to some mad situation somewhere. It goes to like something I saw happen that was usually funny with someone making a mess of something or a bit of crack going on. That's what I remember. And I remember the people I met and the crack I had with them, regardless whether they were military or other people I worked with. So like that's kind of where my memory goes. And when we meet up with guys and ex kind of comrades and whatnot, that's what the conversations are about. Like, they're not about that shootout or that nonsense. It's about the crack here. Remember when this happened to what such and such and or whatever. So, and that's a huge part of it.
Massively, I'd say. And like the leadership as well. Like, what aspects of leadership do you think people most underestimate? I think you referenced in the book, was it Jamie Heaslip's father was someone you kind of pinpointed as a top leader?
Yeah, he was one of the first commanders of special forces in Ireland and one of the kind of pioneers of it. Obviously, like trying to beat down that doors and actually get it signed off where the government would actually allow this unit to be created. So he's a bit of a legend in my eyes and anyone who served in our unit, I guess. But like the kind of man he is, like he's a very humble, very straightforward man. And for me, the essence of leadership is that ability to be able to like create connections with people and relationships where they automatically are at ease with you and they'll work with and for you as needed. So that's the key value I took from that for leadership.
There's a story that I heard from growing up in Kildare that he used to, on his commute, he would swim to work. Is this true?
No better man. Yeah. Like we used to, like what we call those old days, we call them the jackass days because they used to do mad stuff. Like they'd all, because they had a book that someone got in America about special forces and they kind of, and then they
copied it.
Well, yeah, and they send guys off to find out different training areas in America and Germany and Britain. And then they did bring their own ideas. So there was some pretty crazy stuff went on, all right, yeah.
Right, the decompressing in the from tour to home and then to back out, I presume it's much more magnified at the end of your career when you're like, okay, I'm going to get out of this. And then just to make sure that it didn't happen immediately, you were like going back to Afghanistan as a private contractor. Was that a bit of madness, or was that like, I have all these skills, I should use them? Is it actually one of the few available jobs that there is for
Yeah, to be honest, yeah. Like, to be like, you get to a certain, and look, there's nobody an expert in anything, you know, there's no such thing. But like, you have these certain skills, particularly the bodyguarding side of stuff, like the security network in Ireland and VIPs and looking after people. The market isn't there really, you know. Like, yeah, on occasion, yeah, you get certain things, but like, it's a bit tighter. So unfortunately, you have to travel. And usually it's somewhere nasty, like it's, you know, it's either Iraq or Afghanistan, where guys would go off to be a private contractor, you know. So it's, there's a lot of guys doing that, like.
And are you glad that part of your life is over? Or is
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like for me, you know, when lockdown came and I was at home, it was the longest I've been home since I was 18 years old. And it was amazing, you know. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the fact that there was no going back anywhere after it. I was at home and that was it. So I'm very much in that frame of mind now, and I'm really enjoying what I'm doing. I started a training business that's going really well for me. Yeah, it's good. It's a good place, like, yeah.
Is there a bit, is there like an automatic retirement point with the Rangers where you kind of, you have to go, or do you just feel like...
No, there isn't really. Like, once, it depends on contracts, because the Army's contracts are different for different individuals. So for me, for example, I left in sometime in my 40s when I went, and I could have stayed because obviously, even if you're, you know, mid-40s and you're probably getting to your sell-by date in the teams, you can get put into training, you can, you know, there's so much other expertise required in that environment, you know. So, like, as long as you can tick the box and keep going, keep banging out the push-ups, they'll keep you there.
The Afghanistan point you made, one of the main reasons, apart from the fact that obviously it was a massive global story and there was an Irish element, so we're always going to be interested in it, but one of the main reasons that it hit the papers was they had to hitch the ride and they had to hitch a lift. And at a fundamental level, do we pay our defence forces enough? Do we pay the people in our defence forces enough for the jobs that they do?
No. Look, I'm not going to start banging the political drum, but look, that's one of the main reasons why I left Special Forces, because at the time, you know, there was back pay signed off to us and we were getting back 10 years of money. It was 30 grand or whatever was going on. And then they decided it was that you're not getting it. So I'm kind of going, I'm going home to my wife. Like, and we were struggling and I'm away for weeks and doing off stuff all over the country. And trying to look that woman in the eye, and she's going, look, you're working your ass off and we're not making any money here, what's going on? So my kind of decision point came then. And to be honest, it wasn't easy for me to do, because look, I love the military. If the conditions were better for me and I was better paid and so on and so forth, I'd still be in it now.
You're at the elite level as well.
Like, it's hard. Like, and even what the government invests in an operator, training a guy from start, from what we call flash to bang, from start to finish of that, like, training pipeline where he starts off, he trains, he goes in operations. Like, you'll train a guy up in 18 months. At 3 years, he'll be at a higher level. But it takes about 6 to 8 years to get a guy where he's in a position where he'll be very, very focused. His decision-making will be better. So, and, like, then not to look after him, manage him correctly, you know, it's sinful, really.
It's really weird that we invest that money and then belt them all out and don't pay them enough at any point along the way. And then, you know, they have trouble recruiting.
They do that. And to be fair with guys, like, guys don't join the military to be wealthy. But, like, you know, you'll get so far on your own kind of, you know, ability to work hard and do your best. But that's fine as a younger man. But then when you start getting married and having families and stuff, and then there's other things come into play, and it's harder on guys and girls then to keep everything going when they're trying to look after families, you know.
Yeah, that's when life becomes complicated.
Absolutely, for all of us, yeah. Not just
like, Ray, when you mentioned the Afghanistan, and obviously heavily in the headlines recently, but just maybe a word on those guys who were, you know, doing those extractions of Irish citizens over in Afghanistan. As Ger mentioned, they're hitching a lift, but what they were doing, not really knowing how long they were going to be there or how they were going to get home, was quite a remarkable thing that maybe has gone under the radar a little bit in Ireland.
Yeah, I agree. Like, you know, to have that courage to step off that aircraft, and you don't know when the next one is back, or is there one, and what's your plan B if it goes pear-shaped? And not just the guys from the ARW, because they're trained and they're happy enough to deal whatever comes their way, and they'll make the best of it. But the guys from the Department of Foreign Affairs, like the courage of those two people to, you know, to keep going with that and like help out and do what they could is immense. But like, it could have been simply solved. And this is like, you know, the military have been on about this problem for 20 years, about this magic aircraft that will carry enough people. And like, if we had that aircraft and the decision to go was made earlier, we'd have had, any Irish people would have been on it, you know, and we'd have like delayed the decision, narrowed the gap, made it harder for everybody to come.
And we might have been able to help other people escape as well.
Absolutely, like, absolutely. Like, instead of
taking away space from other countries, offering space to other countries.
Like, there's a certain amount of, you know, you have a seat in the Security Council. There are certain things you need to be able to do yourselves as a sovereign nation, and not just bum off other people to do it.
Yeah. Okay. The book is called Ranger 22: Lessons from the Front. Ray Goggins, and thanks very much for joining us. And best of luck with the TV series. Will there be a season 3?
I cannot answer that question.
Right. Okay.
I can answer that question.
Okay. Well, we'll wait and see. Thanks a million, Ray. Cheers.
Thanks.
OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be talking with David Murnaghan about his swim to raise money for the RNLI. That's next.
I think every team realistically would be speaking about it. I've always said that unless I felt drunk with an All-Ireland, I wouldn't play, because the sacrifices are just too high.
OTB AM, live weekday mornings from 7:30 on the OTB Sports app.